Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second podcast of 2021. It is the Slacker Podcast with me, your host, Phil Taggart. Hello to you all. I hope you're getting through the year. I hope you're healthy. I hope you're safe. And if you have taken ill, that you're getting better. And you're watching loads of crap TV, listening to loads of podcasts, listening to loads of music. Or maybe you're just like me, and it really hasn't changed your work up that dramatically. I mean, I'm freelancing, sort of sitting in the house recording stuff and crackpotting ideas. I'm missing a lot of things. I'm missing family. I'm missing going to the pub. I'm missing friends. God, do you like the order that I got things in there as well? Definitely my priority list. Last week's podcast with Alan McGee went down really well. You know, like, we normally get artists on here, but I mean, Alan McGee is partly some of the brains behind, like, you know, Oasis and Primal Scream, the Happy Mondays, and just, like, yeah, loads of artists like that. So he just had so many incredible stories of the 80s and the 90s of rock and roll. Like, if you like your sort of folklore and just sort of an insight into what music was like back then. And now, because he's still releasing music with bands like The Clockworks. Go back and listen to last week's one. If you're just new to the podcast, then hello to you. You have a lot of binging to do. The podcast seems to have taken hold of the US quite, I mean, maybe in a very minor music interview podcast way. But yeah, hello to all our US listeners as well. It's like the numbers have been going up that's out for a long time. The last couple that we've had on: Future Island, Sean Paul, Connor Oberst, Ray, Tim Minchin, Action Bronson, Matt Berninger, Kurt Vile, Jake Bug, Idols, Daniel Avery, Jarvis Cockerheim, Leon Lavis, Jaden Smith, Bob Geldof, Run the Jewels, Sleaford Mods, KSI, Phineas, Johnny Burrell. Ugh. Right, I'm out of breath. But yeah, there's plenty of you to go back and have a little look through. So yeah, if you want to get involved with the Slacker Patreon, you can by going to patreon.com/theslackerpodcast. I'm not going to spend all day sort of telling you what goes on there or whatever, but you can go there. Also, I have a new show. I'm going to say that this show is sponsored by my new show, which is called Chill the Beats, which is a 2-hour music show where I play the best chilled out music anywhere in the world. And it is on Spotify exclusively. It's nowhere else. You can only listen to it on Spotify. It comes out every single Sunday. There's a bonus episode, themed episode of, like, you know, chill jazz music, chill hip hop music, motivation music, feel good music. This show, Chill the Beats, all one word, CHILLDABEATS, is designed for the month of January. It really is. Like, January is such a month that just sucks the serotonin out of your body through your little toe, and you need to put it back in some way, shape or form. So if you go to Spotify and type in Chill the Beats, there is 2 hours of me waffling in between the most elegiac, beautiful alternative chill music, and we have some incredible guests who come on as well, like Liam Gallagher and Dodi and Oliver Arnold. I'm gonna make this the best music show, or show with music, whatever they call them on Spotify. On Spotify, it's gonna happen, trust me. Right, on to this week's podcast. It is with Rue from Enter Shikari, who I've interviewed a couple of times now. He was in my book, The Slacker's Guide to the Music Industry, which you can still get online, and I love talking to him. He's so open, he's so honest, he's so interesting. He's got views on so many different things that I have views on too, that I like either talking to him about or challenging him about, and he's just a super interesting guy. So here it is, the Slacker Podcast with Rue from Enter Shikari in 3, 2, 1.
What has kept you occupied then for the last little while? Because you dropped a record, and like the record goes straight to number two. And really, at this stage, you should be traveling the world and talking to German radio stations and Romanian and whatever the equivalent of the Romanian NME is, and doing all the rest of it. Yet you're just stuck in North London in your house, like.
Yeah, it's been so weird. We had to cancel all of our promotion around the album, and then obviously all of festival season as well. So this is the longest we've gone since of the band without playing a show, the longest I've gone without seeing the rest of the lads, full stop, actually. It's all been very, not very odd. I've sort of just taken to the hermit lifestyle. I'm writing a book at the moment.
You've written a couple of books before, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
like with albums,
books, probably a bit too grand a title, but essays basically about, you know, the lyrical intention and the inspirations behind the songs and stuff. But this one actually is more of a non-fiction book, so it's not like, it's not split up by individual essays about the songs on the last album. It's now like as one, written as one piece. It's almost like investigative journalism in a way. There's just in the first page and on the introduction, there's like about 6 citations. It's getting pretty detailed. That's what happens, I suppose, when you're on your own in a house writing a book.
Do you feel like you're losing your shit? Like sometimes when you're like deep into it, like you haven't seen anybody in days.
So often. Yeah. I mean, just before I got on this call, I was on about the 5th draft of my like sort of, I don't know whether they're chapters yet or what, like sections, I guess. But still in my head in a bit. But I just have to balance it with, you know, getting outside and staying active.
doing normal things. Like, are you and the boys quite good on Zoom together? Or are you meeting up and having like I've been drinking and playing cards with my friends on Zoom.
Yeah.
Like once a week or once a fortnight, we play poker and get absolutely shit faced, and it's so much fun.
Amazing. Yeah. I've found like I'm having the second wave of enthusiasm for like Zoom calls. Like, so it's that initial wave where everyone was like, oh, it's fine, we can just like hang out on Zoom and everything. You know, and quizzes and all of that.
I can't stand the quizzes now. I'm so over it, like so done.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Everyone just got really sick of it. So some of my friends did like one of them, what they call them board games, like is it Cluedo, like the detective kind of board games. They did one of those and all like dressed up as characters and like did it in character and stuff. I'm sad I missed that one, but that looked like quite interesting. Like, level up on the Zoom game.
Yeah, big time. So the podcast, the Slacker Podcast, we start with a demo, and we have a demo of Enter Shikari here, and I'll just blast into it. We'll talk off the back. This is Sorry You're Not a Winner. is that instrument? Like it's half like sounds like half like a flute and half like Psycho, you know, that
It's just a really bad MIDI. Now what I think it was done on a Korg Electribe. So it has like an onboard it's a synthesizer sequencer and it's got like one menu where it has, you know, like real instruments,
yeah.
But they sort of have that, you know, endearingly bad quality to them where they sort of sound like synthesized and kind of rough around the edges. And yeah, I think it was one of those.
The first thing that strikes me when I listen to that is you sound so like young. You sound like as a band, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you sound like kids, even like your voice, it doesn't like feel like it broke in the same way. Like, I know it had, like, yeah. but like it's got. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have that maturity that you get after a couple of albums.
Yeah. Well, I think we were 17. So yeah, I guess, you know, my voice, I was still not even just in the kind of tone of it. It also, I think, in the way I was like singing, like there's words on there. Quite a few, in fact, that make me cringe because I'm clearly not singing in my own voice. There's an American accent, you know, in the remember, like all that
remember
kind of stuff.
Remember me.
I'm like, yeah, it's odd listening back to it. Yeah, I think I was sort of still working out, you know, what sort of singer I was going to be, because before Enter Shikari, I'd been in bands that were kind of straight up hardcore punk, so I was just screaming, and then straight up sort of experimental alternative muse wannabe bands as well. So I developed my sort of falsetto, that register, and this was the first time I was like, okay, no, come on, we're actually going to make a band now that is interesting and like represents the music we were brought up on and intrigues us and excites us.
Does it take like being in a couple of other bands to kind of get there, to get it right?
It certainly did for us. I mean, I've been in bands with Rob and Chris since we were 11. Like, Chris got his first guitar when he was 9.
My God, that's so early. Like, what the hell do you play when you're 11?
Like, I know. I mean, there's some... We have to dig him out one day, but there's probably going to be a lot of embarrassing recordings. He had a tape recorder as well. We used to, like... do faux radio shows and,
amazing,
like,
yeah.
Just like stupid stuff. And yeah,
what sort of songs would you play? Like obviously you'd be like covering stuff, but even like, can you remember what it would be?
I mean, I remember having it was like the ultimate Beatles collection. So it was just the chords, but it had the tab as well for like solos and things. But Chris was a far more accomplished guitar player than me, like in the early days. So we kind of just went through that, basically just learned our trade by going through the Beatles back catalogue. And then as we sort of grew up and started to develop our own, maybe not even taste, but our own sort of intrigue for music, you know, getting into Britpop, and we'd play our sort of primary school fates.
Yeah.
And then when we were in secondary school, we did sort of like birthdays and, you know, other sorts of parties and the odd gigs here and there. And we were still, you know, up until we were about 14, then we made our first band where we were actually playing originals.
So were you kind of like a novelty in St Albans then? Like, because you were the band, the young band that sort of turned up and played everything?
Well, in a way, well, we were a three-piece known as Hybrid, which was, yeah, very much like sort of... kind of eerie, had a lot of eerie electronics. No, that was even before that. Sorry, Hybrid, yeah, was a three-piece which literally sounded like Muse. Like
right, yeah.
You can tell it, but then...
I don't feel like Muse have dated that well. I'm a massive, like, I was a massive Muse fan back in the day. And up until, like, probably Absolution, I really, really, really loved Muse. And I heard a track the other day and it made me feel really old because I didn't feel like it had stuck the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I sort of lost. I mean, they were my favorite band for about a year, I think, and then I sort of lost interest. I think I was pulled towards the more extremes. You know, I was when I was 14, I was just like sort of discovering proper punk rock and hardcore and drum and bass. And, you know, we were very lucky with our local scene. There was all sorts of stuff. But yeah, we didn't, by the, before we had a little gap, I suppose. Hybrid was like doing Battle of the Bands and doing like very small little youth club things and school things.
Yeah, I played those ones, yeah.
Yeah, then when Enter Shikari started, it was almost like a fresh start. So, but people sort of, yeah, perhaps a lot of people didn't even see the link, you know, because there was a little gap where we just went away and just practiced and reinvented or invented ourselves for the first time, probably, really.
Did you win any of the Battle of the Bands?
We came second.
And then, so can you remember who you got beat by?
Well, there were qualifiers, and I can remember we played... there was a qualifier at each school in St. Albans, I think. And we got through to the final, which was at the Alban Arena, which is like a pantomime venue, really. It's like a sort of 1,500 cap place. So it was, you know, massive for us. This is insane. But yeah, we came second to a ska punk band called Dexter's Fish.
You always remember who you came second to. Like my band won a couple of Battle of the Bands. We entered every single one going, but I remember the first one we did, we got beat by two sisters singing Alanis Morissette, and I remember getting beat by them. And I also remember winning like a Battle of the Bands in Northern Ireland, the Northern Irish Heat. So we got to like, it was like Fight the Nations, England versus Scotland versus Wales. And it was in Newcastle. And there was a band that sounded like the Young Knives. Do you remember them?
Yeah.
And they were kind of like dressed. It was around that time everybody was wearing checked shirts with the button done up to the top. And
yeah.
And I remember like us traveling the whole way to Newcastle. And I think it was like sponsored by like Jack Daniels or something. And we ended up like not winning. And we were like going, fuck this. Well, we go see where Biker Grove was filmed. And then that was the end of it.
What was the venue in Newcastle? I'm intrigued.
It was called the Clooney.
Clooney, oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah. When you started Enter Shikari, how many of the like original members when you started Enter Shikari are still in the band, or is it completely...
Oh, it's always been the four of us. Yeah. I've always been sort of... I mean, I say this now, but if circumstances had been different, I might not be say this so intensely. But like, I've always been of the kind of frame of mind that your band is your band, the members are the band, and if the members change, then it's a different band, there's a different dynamic, a different atmosphere. You know, like as well growing up, say, you know, the Beatles were four guys. If you changed any one of those, it would be
very
different. Although of course Ringo was their second drummer, but
but it's difficult like to keep a group of people together for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely like you see that even with like couples or whatever, it's difficult to keep couples together for a while. Never mind four people.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. In the sort of, you know, environment of a rock and roll touring band as well. There's a lot of pressure there, a lot of sleep deprivation and moods and,
fisticuffs and petrol station wind-ups and all, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All the rest of it. But when you guys started out at the beginning, I think it was very sort of, I remember reading about you guys in the NME, and I remember reading that you were like on tour on a post van or something like that.
Yeah, we had a secondhand Royal Mail van that was basically a death trap, really. We had a few crashes in that thing, a few near misses. We ended up blowing it up in a video, actually, because we thought it's going to blow us up at some point, so we need to get rid of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we did that thing up and down the UK for a few years, and, you know, it was your classic. But a lot of other bands at that time were doing the same thing. There was mold on the seats. There wasn't really anywhere comfortable enough to sleep, but you sort of made it work. And with a guitar on your lap and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Is there like one gig of those early days when you were in that van that sort of sticks out a little bit more than the rest? Because I know some of them can kind of drift into, you know, it's the same place, but you might be playing to 30 people one night, 50 people, 100 people, whatever. But is there one that like you and the boys go, do you remember that gig?
Mate, there's so many.
I love. I'm a huge fan of the war stories. Like, I'll swap ones with you if you swap ones with me.
Well, what sort of category of memory are we looking for?
Like, I just like the really bizarre ones. Like the time my band went and played got paid £1,000, which is the most we'd ever been paid by about 10 times, to go and play a Beatles tribute festival in Moville in Donegal. Nobody turned up, and we learned half of we learned an hour of Beatles songs and an hour of our own songs, and the promoter legged it without paying us. So we asked the woman at reception of the hotel where he lived so we could drop off an amp to his house, and we went up and frog marched him down to the bank to pay us the money.
Wow. Oh my god.
But I've got loads of those ones. Like, when you like, you get more way better stories from before you have like the industry side rolling with you, because when you've got a booking agent and a tour manager and all the rest of it, it takes out all the variables and all the weirdos.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, but I mean, we booked our own shows for years, and the stress of that is enough to send you loopy. Okay, so what should I start with? God. I mean, the first one that just comes to mind was, because sadly Reading is obviously on my mind, but we played a show at the Cellar Bar, I think, in Reading. And I remember we broke one cable, and the promoter tried to tell us that it was worth like £1,000 or something. And we were like, well, I think it was just like a normal jack cable. Yeah. You know, even if it wasn't, it would, there's no way it would be anywhere near that. And we basically refused to, like, he withheld our money, which was probably only like 50 quid petrol anyway, but he blocked us in with his van and said that he wanted to frog march us down to
what? Passage. What an absolute asshole! Like, this is a young band that like a.
No. I presume it's that classic thing of maybe he just felt disrespected or something. Not that I mean, we were pretty lively in those days, but we were always sort of well managed to the promoters, and they clearly knew that we're not trying to break anything. But yeah, I can remember him threatening to get his, and I quote, carny mates down to beat us all up if we don't go and get him his money.
You should have like Googled to see whether the carnival was in town that day. Like, you were like, well, actually, I've just checked this out, and you're chatting shit.
Yeah, but yeah, there's been so much of that kind of thing. The It's almost always over. Most of our stories are over equipment, either our equipment getting destroyed by other bands, or us destroying equipment, or, you know, bits of venues or piping or something. Or
that's what happens with your band, though, like, because like you have it's not even just about how high energy and high octane your shows are, but your fans are pretty mental as well. Like, they like throwing themselves about.
Like, yeah, and I think there was a lot of miscommunication and misinterpretation of like the way that people would act in that scene as well. You know, like, people still didn't really understand what moshing was or what hardcore dancing was, or, you know, there was this air of like, especially locally for us, the amount of run-ins we had with our local council, there was an air of like danger and like, you know, out of control youth doing their drugs and getting in fights and stuff, whereas in reality, most of the time, it was the complete opposite. It was a community. It was getting kids off streets and doing something, you know, creative and communal and beneficial. Yeah.
What's the difference between moshing and hardcore dancing for the uninitiated?
Oh, Christ. There's a whole politics around this, isn't there?
Is there? I honestly don't know. This isn't a loaded question, because I want to know.
Well, I would say there's like hardcore dancing, which is same as slam dancing, probably a load of other terms, which is the more of the art form, you know, where it's like windmilling and sort of more martial art. It looks like that. And then you get things like crowd killing, which is like running into the side of the kind of people watching if there's like a, you know, a circle that comes out in the audience and all that kind of thing. Whereas moshing, I would say, is just more like,
it's more headbanging and shoulders, right?
Yeah, and like pogoing, as they called it in the 70s. And, yeah.
But it is interesting, because, like, I mean, moshing, crowd surfing, two of the things I absolutely loved when I was like a teenager, and like the older you get, the farther back at the venue, say, like the venue is just one small black room. Like, yeah, you start off in your teenage years at the front, and just by the older you get, the further back you get, and I think then you get to a certain point and you're really old and you go back up again. I
went to a Gary Numan gig just before lockdown, and I was so happy because it was a seated. It was upstairs at the at the Forum in Kentish Town.
Yeah,
and we had a table. It was lovely. That's best, when you know you get
best experience ever.
Yeah,
but there's always one, right? When everybody's like made the circle for the pit, I'm like all for the energy and I really enjoy it, right? But I'll have always just come back with a pint, right? And I'll have handed my pint to my missus or my friend or whoever I'm with. And there's just one person who doesn't respect the circle and just goes flying out through it on purpose. And you're just like, respect the circle. Yeah. What is the sort of biggest circle pit or biggest sort of crowd moment that you've had? Because I'd imagine you're like a bit of a hardcore conductor with the crowd at times.
Trying to remember a specific. There's been quite a few. You know, the classic thing of getting like a circle pit round the front of house, the sound desk, is always pretty spectacular.
I haven't seen that done before.
Oh man, yeah, it looks like you know, the Mecca when people are like doing the religious walk around. Yeah, it's pretty incredible to watch from stage. Yeah, I'm trying to think. There was actually what's the festival that ran in. Was it? There was one in Northern Ireland and one in Scotland, and it was like
Oxygen.
Yeah,
Oxygen was in the south of Ireland, but like it was a partner with Tea in the Park.
Yeah, I think that was it. I can remember specifically there being a massive circle pit at that one, and the classic thing of kids were climbing up the like the tent stanchions.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that happen. I remember MGMT when their first Irish show had to be called off. Which, to be fair, like was like they were so bad at the beginning that like I mean they did themselves a favor, the guy who climbed up the pole, because like they just really were thrown in the deep end too early. Like, but there's nothing more frightening than watching that person up there. Like, it's mm-hmm. proper car crash as well. You can't take your eyes off it, but yet you're feeling absolutely sick looking at it.
Yeah, I remember going back again into sort of the very early years of touring. I think we were playing. I think it was Doncaster, and this kid had climbed up. He was scaling the front of the PA. And so he basically his fingertips were in the mesh of the PA of the speaker. So he was climbing up, and the security grabbed hold of his leg and dragged him off.
No,
and he left half of his finger up in the mesh.
Oh, no.
It was like, you know, I'm exaggerating. It was like his full nail and then sort of the top, it being sliced off the metallic mesh of the PA. You always do worry.
God, I lost my finger at an Enter Shikari show. That's a t-shirt there. I mean, you guys are pretty good with your merch. There you go.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I know from from bands back home in Northern Ireland, like they prefer tour, a lot of them anyway, I don't know if it's the same now, but like a lot of them preferred touring in Europe than they did in the UK because they'd make more money and they were treated better. Do you think that like UK promoters and UK music venues really have the same TLC for their artists as they do in Europe? Because like from me going around, if you get like two bottles of water between six people, it doesn't really seem fair, does it?
Yeah. Well, I think it's fairly classic, isn't it? Especially when you're playing sort of the very kind of corporate venue circuit, which I guess is a little bit bigger than your kind of average, you know, small town venue size. Mm-hmm. But then it becomes literally like you're being used as a commodity or something, you know. But no, Europe is certainly a level above in, as you say, TLC. Like just the catering, for instance, like German, Dutch, Belgian catering is just so good. Like at festivals and at venues as well. It's just they really seem to put effort into that aspect of trying to make you feel comfortable.
I've heard so many stories of like the actual person promoting the show taking the small band who's playing or maybe even second on the bill into their home and feeding them at their kitchen table and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, I think that's just thing of just like there's an appreciation, like, because you know a promoter and a band should be a partnership. You know, you're both working to put on, you know, what should be a great night of entertainment and community for your locality. And often it can be the complete opposite. There can be a kind of environment of distrust to, you know, the promoter, between the promoter and the band. I think we learned that very quickly through our sort of troubles that we got ourselves into.
Yeah.
That it was all about picking like good people who cared about the music, who understood the music, and then we cared about their venue and their reputation and everything else. And it was, yeah, it's getting those partnerships.
One of my friends, they play in a sort of post-rock band, and they've, like, you know, they tour Eastern Europe quite a lot, and they've had so many run-ins with like the police and with going across customs and having to bribe like people, or like, you know, people going, you need money to get over and do this, that, and the other. Have you ever come across that in your travels? Like, because it like going from country to country, it's hard to not find yourself in those situations.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of countries the further east you get that that's almost built into a lot of the like the institutions and you know the various forms, what do they call it, the carne, like the contracts for your gear, basically to take your gear around the world, like internationally. It can be a real ball ache, but as well sometimes it comes down to literally like tipping people off and kind of, you know.
Is there anybody at a port that's wearing an Enter Shikari t-shirt now, like?
Oh yeah, I mean, in the amount of times, like crossing the American-Canadian border is really just potluck. Sometimes you'll get like a complete job's worth asshole who'll just like search every bit of your van and keep you on the border for hours and hours, and even though that's a border we've crossed so many times, and it's quite clear, you know, we're not a problem of any sort. And then you'll get the, I think we've about three or four times now we've had an officer who knows of the band and is like really excited to speak. Oh,
that's
to
really
us.
Cool. Yeah.
We've given merch to quite a few times actually. But then you end up spending just the same amount of time at the border,
chatting.
But much nicer for a much nicer reason.
What is your reception like in the sort of North Americas? Is it similar to over here? Because like I know the fan base here is rabid. Like, is it the same around the world?
The intensity and the passion is, which we're eternally grateful for. North America, we certainly don't have the sort of spread that we do here. I think as international as our music and my lyricism attempts to be. I think at our core, we're still quite clearly a sort of British band, or even a European band.
Yeah.
And I think America likes its sort of segregating its genres and having things neatly in genres, so you can understand it quickly and you know what to expect. Whereas I think Britain perhaps has this kind of history of real artistry and like pioneering in terms of like the creative industries and bands and art and stuff. So I don't know. It's probably a bit of a generalization here, but yeah, I think America sort of struggles to understand what we're trying to do because they just don't have the cultural history that we've come from.
It's a tough nut not to crack. And even people, I was watching I had Bob Geldof on the podcast. I'm not sure when this is coming out, but he was like talking about how they traveled the US, every single state, tried to do as many cities as they could over and over and over again, and they just couldn't crack it. And it's so tiring, because by the time you finished like spending a year, 18 months, 2 years trying to get into the US, like the people back home in the UK are like, where's the next record? And you're like, I'm really tired.
Yeah. I mean, we've known bands that have actually moved there and just like basically given it a year of their life to just go, okay, let's do this. Mm. And I think that's one way of doing it now. But I think music in general, but like our scene, or at least the scene we got lumped in with in America, is so saturated. So it's like people sort of look at us, and if on surface, if they choose to see a, however they want to describe it, metalcore, or even though we're clearly not that, but they'll see that, and then they'll go, well, I already like, you know, all these metalcore bands, and we have them here in America, so why would I sort of, you know, give effort into working out what these guys are about?
Like your dalliances with the record industry have been pretty like novel. Like you've always had held a little bit of a sort of DIY spirit about what you guys do, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Purely through necessity, really.
Well, nobody signed you at the start.
No, we spent and we were aiming for that. You know, we were sending off our demos to lots of labels. At the same time, beginning to learn about friends' bands or friends of friends that had been, you know, treated very badly by the industry, or, you know, got themselves into deals that they probably shouldn't have gotten into, and slowly built up a kind of weariness about the inner workings of it, really. And then we made our label purely out of necessity because no one wanted to put it out. And it was only when we recorded it and we were about to put it out and we had success with our first single and, you know, we got a booking agent by that point, then the labels became super interested.
It's typical, isn't it? Like they won't take the chance until they know it's a winner.
Yeah. But like, we were very lucky that like our manager Ian got involved just at the right point, because we would have, you know, we would have been like wide-eyed, you know, bushy-tailed kids jumping into, this is a record contract. Oh my God, we're going to be a real band.
Did you ever get that sweet talk from like any of the major labels where they'd like drive you around in a limo or
I mean, well, not quite that, but like, you know, been taken out for meals and just them trying to sort of make out like they knew who we were and what we needed and what we wanted to hear and everything. That was a very odd time, but I'm so sort of so glad that we made that decision to keep it DIY. And you know, a year after that, I'd sort of then discovered like the history of DIY, really. So from Factory Records here in the UK, Discord Records, and like the whole DIY hardcore scene in America. And it was then I was like, oh, we did the same thing. Oh, and I sort of, it was then that I sort of knew we'd made the right decision.
It is mad though. Like you must have some sort of record, because like you got 6 records out and like they've all done really well chart-wise. Like, and that's very rare for DIY, you know, do you know what I mean? That's rare for DIY. Yeah. Like normally, like a DIY label will have a couple of successes, but
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I, you know, every time we get in like the, you know, the top 10, I find myself saying that, yeah, this is odd, because not, you know, not only are we a independent band, we're quite far from the middle of the road, quite far from music you'd expect to see in the top 10. It's very diverse. It's difficult to get into because every song is really quite different, and then every era is quite different as well. It's yeah, so it's,
you got,
I'm not really,
2020. Sorry, 2020 was the year that you went to number two. Who was number one? Probably Lewis Capaldi. I was just gonna say probably Lewis Capaldi.
No, it wasn't, although Lewis Capaldi had been in, I mean, he's, that album hasn't gone out of the top five like
no,
for about a year.
Nah.
I think he was third or fourth. And he, after the midweeks, he was catching us up, and I tweeted him saying, "Oh mate, come on, just take 1 week off, would you?" And he replied saying like, yeah, he would. And that he bought the album, and he did a screenshot of his copy and everything. And he was saying that he had, back in the Bebo days, one of his scream names was one of our songs and stuff. So
funny. I love Lewis Capaldi. Like I've got a good relationship with him. Like,
he seems like a great chap. I think it was, is it Jerry Cinnamon?
Yeah. Oh, Jerry Cinnamon. Right. Okay. Yeah.
He was number one. Yeah.
Well, you're in a Scottish sandwich there.
Yeah, absolutely.
When's Northern Ireland going to have somebody? It's been too long. Scotland's getting all the luck right now. But yeah, like, I mean, that is incredible. And as you said, like, actually something I thought was quite interesting is like, there's been so many different sort of styles of Enter Shikari. Do you know what I mean? Like you're not scared of switching it up. I remember like, I've like definitely in the past gone, who's that? And then heard it and like gone, that's not Enter Shikari, is it? And then you're like going, it is, and it's good. You're not scared of going left or right?
I feel quite grateful that our audience has given me quite a long leash as a songwriter. They let me roam the full musical spectrum, and they seem to accept it. Like, I mean, obviously there's always going to be a certain percentage of any fan base that is always going to say, oh, we should go back to this album or whatever. But I think because our second album was such a clear departure from the first, people realized that we were never going to be the type of band that would just be, you know, dredging out the same sort of music over and over again. And I think that's like the main thing that keeps me going. And I'm so interested in music full stop, that being able to be this fidgety creative who is able to explore regions of musicality that I perhaps haven't done before. I mean, that's what really gives me the spur of enthusiasm and the enjoyment, really, the euphoria of songwriting something new is incredible.
If you're able to go left on a song and right on a song, have you ever now looking back feel like you've gone on a wrong turn? and like, have you ever looked back on songs or albums and you've been a little bit like, oh God.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's stuff I would have done differently, but I think I kind of rate our back catalog in terms of honesty, like how honest was it? Like, does the song encapsulate as best I could whatever I wanted to encapsulate? And, you know, that to me is more what I look back on rather than like, oh, Johnny Sniper is fucking terrible as a song, or like, oh, I wish something other than Sorry I'm Not a Winner wasn't the song that we were kind of massively known for back then. But
is there a song that stands out as your favorite? Like, if tomorrow you got hit by a bus and somebody were writing down his, and this is the song that he wanted played, what would it be?
I have no idea. That's so difficult.
It is.
Well, I guess if it was funeral, I'd want to make everyone cry. So I'd pick I'd pick like Constellations or Dear Future Historians or Airfield, like one of the slower ballads.
But
yeah,
you should just go for the mashup one and like crowd surf yourself into the coffin.
Yeah. I think it's certainly the one I'm most proud of at the moment is off the last album, Elegy for Extinction, which is, but it's a classical piece, and it's something that I'd wanted to do for years on this scale. And the amount of work that went into that and the amount of coaxing I had to do of myself to do that, because I'm not the most sort of immediately confident person, especially in my own abilities. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would be the one I'd probably play to.
You, as you said yourself, you're creatively fidgety. Does that mean like work with other people as well? Like I mean, do you want to produce other people? Because obviously you're so musical. Like do you work with other artists, or is it always like this is the Shikari show?
I only kind of just started to these last few years. I think again, it's been a big thing is confidence. Like for someone who's always written by himself, it was usually quite scary for me to even attempt to think of writing with another human being, because it's, for me, it is really a very emotional, very honest process. But yeah, like the year before last, I started doing a bit of like pop writing on the side, which is really interesting
Did any of the tracks come out?
Yeah, a few of them did. Well, my favorite was, what was it?
Are we getting them going?
There's an artist called Henrik Hoven.
Oh yeah.
Who's such a talented sort of pop R&B, kind of thing. And his voice is absolutely incredible. And we wrote a song called Weekend that was, I still listen to it. It's such a summer banger. It's like, you know, it's pure pop, but like melodies are great. Like it's a real feel good track. So I did stuff like that. I mean, it's pretty far from my writing process for Any Shikari, but I learned a lot. And I've just started, you know, now I produced our last album by myself. I've now started to consider myself a producer. So I'm starting to mix a few tracks and look at working with other bands and artists as well.
That's wicked. One thing I've always loved about Shikari is that like you've used your platform for good. Like you've used your platform to speak about like, you know, things that are topical to young people and to good people. And like, has that been difficult over the years? Because like so many people, and I disagree with this massively, say bands should just stick to music and they shouldn't be talking about politics. Where, I mean, I kind of see that's bullshit. If you've got a platform, use it, right?
Yeah, and what else is there to talk about? Do you know what I mean? Like everything, in this day and age especially, everything's related to politics. Like there's no escaping it. It would be a political decision to not talk about politics. You know what I mean? That's just a classic way to stunt communication, to stunt conversation, to stunt thought. I mean, it used to frustrate me incredibly, but now I've come to expect it from people who either have an agenda to silence some sort of political discussion that they don't like, or, you know, political leaning that they don't like. Mm-hmm. Or it's someone who's just hugely ignorant of the way we work as humans. Like discourse, communication is all we have. Speaking about things that matter is all we have. What's the alternative? Violence. So it's stupid, but you just have to, I've tried to become more patient over the last few years. Like,
yeah, it's very hard to be patient on social media. Even the Dalai Lama or Buddha would have difficulty not giving off on Twitter. You know.
Yeah. It's a test. It's a constant test, I think. And it's like with empathy. Like, it's really interesting because empathy is considered, you know, such a positive human trait, and when we empathize, we usually do it to things that we're sort of clearly meant to empathize with, you know, various, like we're empathizing with Black people right now with the whole BLM movement, and rightly so, obviously, but we need to start using our ability for empathy or of empathy in places where it's actually hard. So like, say for instance, if someone comes to me with some racist opinion or sexist opinion or homophobic opinion or what, you know, whatever it is, I have to approach that with patience and empathy and think, okay, this person has obviously been indoctrinated, or he's grown up in some sort of environment where this view was fed to him. So it's not his fault. So I have to detach his personage, his ego, his entity from this view and think, okay, how can I persuade this person or like show this person a different way of thinking? And that's the only way we're ever going to see progress.
Has that ever worked? Because like, I mean, when if somebody comes in with a real strong idea, it's very hard to talk them out of it unless they're just saying something that's misinformed and they're just a bit stupid. Do you know what I mean?
It's incredibly hard, but I think part of that reason
that's not me saying don't do it, but like not for a second. Like, you should do it all the time, and like, we should all be pulled up on stuff that we do and say. I mean, everybody in 2020 is a different version of themselves than they were in 2010 than they were in the year 2000. You know, there's like, I think everybody is, as a community and a society, is growing together, and what's acceptable now maybe wasn't. Like, you're seeing a lot of it now, and it's all happening for the best. Like,
yeah, it's you know, it's one long road, and I think the better we get at empathizing, the more we'll see that working. Like, you know, as I say, the opposite is just violence, or it's ridiculing someone, which is our favorite thing to do on social media because it gets us points and likes and retweets. But of course, ridiculing someone certainly is never going to persuade that person.
No.
So yeah, it's an interesting topic, and yeah, there's obviously different degrees of patience that we should have for different types of beliefs, but yeah, I think as a general way of progress, I think trying to have a bit more empathy and a bit more patience is something that the whole of society needs, for sure.
I think we spoke about this before, but like, we're both card carrying anxiety sufferers, right? Like, and have been for quite some time. I've noticed that, like, you've got into mindfulness in a big way, right?
Yeah, mindfulness is I sort of properly discovered it in 2015. I sort of had, you know, as we all seem to do, at least at one point in our life, you just have one year where just everything goes wrong and everything falls apart, and mindfulness became one of my tools that I learned in order to survive, really. And it's one that I've kept up, and it's one that I've found not just helpful on a personal level, you know, to do with my mental health, but I find it like really interesting, like as just a process of discovering how our inner lives work, how our minds work, our cognition. I think it's something that we're going to see is eventually taught properly. It's going to be part of like school syllabuses, because you know, we all know how important like physical health is. We all understand the utility of exercise and of diet, but we're not really given any like education on what it's like to be a human inside, you know, what the mental processes, the biases that we're all very capable of, you know, everything that cognitive behavioral therapy goes into. I think that's going to be hopefully going to become much more of a staple in terms of life lessons from an early age.
How like do you see the difference before you started and then when you started? Like how much has your anxiety quelled a little bit since doing that?
Well, for anxiety, it's a weird one for me because I seem to have like two levels. I have just like my functioning normal anxiety, which is I can live with it. It's bearable, and I've from the tools that I picked up from mindfulness, from CBT, like it's okay. Like, I don't have to take medication. I mean, half of that is probably that I choose not to, because I also have introspective anxiety, which means I don't like feeling things that are brought on by chemicals.
Yeah.
So I've never been good at like drugs at all. But yeah, I would say mindfulness has more helped in just a way that just of a deeper level of understanding, I think, of just like our processes, and it helps like spotting when I'm about to enter into a rabbit hole that will lead me to anxiety, that will lead me to obsessive compulsive thoughts, or lead me to like more of a depressed state or whatever else. Mindfulness is like a sort of an alert system. It's like a security guard onto your consciousness. So there's a study out of Harvard, and it's been replicated quite a lot, that says 47% of the time we're on autopilot. So we're not present with our thoughts. And it's usually in those moments that our minds will revisit things that make us anxious because of our evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. We're very conscious of things that are negative. It's a survival technique, effectively. What's going to keep us alive? It's knowing where that tiger is or that bear is or whatever. So it's in those moments of not really subconscious, but just unconscious thought, when you're just, you know, you're being taken away, your mind is wandering. Those are the moments where your mood can be taken, your anxiety can be heightened, your depression can be heightened, whatever else. And mindfulness is obviously being mindful. It's noticing when those moments are there. So it's just a real technique to give you a bit more control, I think, more than anything.
And if somebody wanted to get in, somebody's listening to this right now, and maybe they're getting it a little bit tight. And I think probably the ratio of people getting it a little bit tight in terms of stress and anxiety coming out of a pandemic, hopefully, fingers crossed, is probably more significant. Like, how do they start? Like, what is the best way for somebody to begin doing something like that?
Well, I mean, there's countless number of apps now that are really good.
I use Headspace. I enjoy Headspace because it's only 15 minutes and I have no attention span whatsoever. And the amount of times I started using it at the start of the pandemic, because I know myself that like I should start running and doing this stuff before it starts, because it's basically like going, let's not wait till everything's fucking shit. Let's get ahead of it a little bit. And I find myself falling asleep like loads of times, that you get into your breath and all the rest of it, and it was only meant to be 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and I'd be outside or I'd be like in the house, and I'd wake up and it'd be like an hour and a half later, and I'm like going, whoa. Oh, wow.
That's a classic. I've used Headspace a lot. 10% Happier is another good one. I've just started a podcast, which is the free guided
plug away, man. That's how podcasts get plugged, is on other people's podcast.
Yeah,
plug it to all you can.
Well, yeah, it's called Here Now Together. It started because basically at the start of lockdown, I thought, well, because everyone was doing live streaming, and you know, I did live streaming acoustic sets and stuff as well, I thought, well, what else can I actually do which might be helpful? So I thought I'd relay my experience and my knowledge of mindfulness. And the meditation techniques that I've learned. So I started doing live streamed guided mindfulness meditations.
Love that.
It went down really well. But a lot of people seem to appreciate it. And I think there's so many misperceptions of like what mindfulness is. You know, meditation still suffers from this kind of
hippie-dippy, new-agey. Yeah, like what do you call those? Like those little beads, like on your door, and do you know what I'm saying? But I think there's room out there for like rock and roll yoga, rock and roll mindfulness, rock and roll well-being. Like I think it's, but it's people like you, sort of taking those stigmas out of it that will ultimately help it become, just normalized, really.
Yeah, I hope so. On my podcast, I try and concentrate on like, well, it's all completely like science, has its basis in science rather than having its basis in like Theravada Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism,
yeah,
or in Tao philosophy, or you know, there's obviously modern day mindfulness, like secular meditation, I suppose you could call it, takes so much from those religions, but it also kind of brushes off the needless, more sort of fluffy spiritual language.
And that's what I'm not into. Like I'm kind of more into that sort of style that you're into.
Yeah,
I must start listening to your podcast. This is good. Got a new podcast to listen to now. Listen, I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for coming on the Slacker podcast, for sharing the early Enter Shikari demo. And I will be listening to your meditation podcast, and I will very much be namaste. That's what we're trying to get away from.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that'll be it. All right, Roo. All the best. Thank you so much.
Wicked. Take care, man. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.